All right, I'm gonna go ahead and get started. Hi everybody, my name is Rob Howard. I'm a program manager on the SharePoint Developer Experience team, and I'm gonna talk about Office 365 and SharePoint Online, which is the SharePoint component of Office 365. For those of you who aren't familiar, Office 365 is our hosted service for the next version of Office, SharePoint, Exchange, and Link. And SharePoint Online is that SharePoint component that's hosted by Microsoft and people can acquire couple of different types of tenancy, a standard tenancy and a small business tenancy, in order to get SharePoint hosted by Microsoft. And so my goal today was really to talk about three things. The first thing was talk sort of very briefly. I've got the kind of bulleted list of what's available on-prem and what's available in Office 365 in SharePoint Online, so you can see that. I'm going to talk very, very briefly about sandbox solutions because it's an important thing in SharePoint Online, and while you guys may not particularly be interested in it, there are a couple of aspects I want to point out that you might be interested in. Certainly, I can answer more questions about it, though I kind of left it short in this presentation because I thought you might not be as interested in that as the last piece, which is some specific things around how you authenticate to SharePoint Online. SharePoint Online supports some specific authentication protocols that are, in some cases, in common with SharePoint on-prem servers, but not with the sort of basic installation. So I've got kind of walkthrough of what that protocol looks like and a couple demos there too. And I'll try and keep this relatively short so that you guys have plenty of time to ask questions about Office 365 and SharePoint Online if you have any questions after we're done. All right, so the first thing is just my checklist slide of all the different features you might be interested in SharePoint Online as far as extensibility goes. The first is sandbox solutions, which we'll talk about in just a minute, so don't worry too much about that one if you're not familiar with it. The next one is farm-level solutions. So this is the capability to deploy a solution to SharePoint that actually installs code or pages or full trust entities of some kind onto the SharePoint web front ends. And that's not available in SharePoint Online. Those are web front ends that are shared across thousands, potentially tens of thousands, or even hundreds of thousands of tenants. And so we don't let people deploy their own custom code to those web front ends because they might damage other people's experiences or availability in SharePoint Online. So it's one thing that's very important to note. It's not available in farm-level solutions. We had a question here during Mike's talk about whether you would use server code or the client object model or sandbox solutions or something like that. And because of this bullet point right here, that server code, that full trust server code, the assembly you installed to the GAC on the web front end is not available in SharePoint Online. So keep that in mind. Silverlight web parts, this is just the capability to take a web part, drop it on the page, and point it at a zap file. So that's available in both of those. BCS, which is our capability to connect SharePoint to a line of business system and integrate that within SharePoint's user interface through things like, we call them external data lists. That's not available in SharePoint Online at this point. SharePoint Designer 2010 is available in SharePoint Online, and all of the features of SharePoint Designer are available there. So if you're using SharePoint Designer to create declarative workflows or customized web part pages, custom list views, custom forms, things like that, SharePoint Designer works there. The client object model that Mike spent some time talking about before, that's all available in SharePoint Online, available for you to work against. There's some specific things that you'll want to know about authentication. I'll go through that at the end, but all the functionality is there. Web services, actually, this thing should be there, sorry. Web services, almost all the web services are available. So in terms of those SOAP services, all the things that are available out of the box in SharePoint, most of those are available. There's a couple that you would sort of guess would be turned off, and they're related to farm administration. So things that aren't specific to tenants or content inside of SharePoint, and they're things that a farm administrator would do, are not going to be things that our customers are allowed to do. They're things that our Microsoft administrators would do. So that no farm admin should be up there on web services. Out-of-box browser configuration, things like web parts and themes and applying site templates and CSS files, all of that stuff is definitely available. All that stuff stored in the content database, so it's available in SharePoint Online. You can certainly use Visual Studio 2010 to develop against SharePoint Online. You'll still have to have some version of SharePoint deployed locally on your development machine in order to do that development. But if you're building a sandbox solution, you can compile that solution, you can package that solution, and you can upload it to SharePoint Online and run it there for your custom web parts, event receivers, things like that. But you can't create, again, form solutions with Visual Studio. It's not available in SharePoint Online. InfoPath forms also have this sort of similar flavor of farm versions, full trust InfoPath forms and sandbox InfoPath forms. Again, in SharePoint Online, you can create those sandboxed InfoPath forms with those custom logic behind it, but you can't create farm ones. And finally, workflows. Custom code-based workflows can't be created in SharePoint Online, but you can create declarative workflows using things like SharePoint Designer, and you can create code-based workflow activities that run in the sandbox in SharePoint Online as well. So that's my quick rundown of what is available in SharePoint Online and what's only available in SharePoint on-prem. Any questions about that before I move on to do a real quick talk about sandbox solutions? Sweet. All right, so here's just a kind of high-level thing about major investments in SharePoint Online 2010 developer experience and capabilities. A lot of these modern APIs are things that Mike already talked about, so things like our OData REST APIs, Link, which is a server-side capability, but also available in the CSOM, our client object model, the AJAX capabilities that we have, Silverlight web parts. Most of those have already been sort of covered in Mike's session or in previous sessions. If you have any questions about those, I'm happy to talk about them as well. We also have in 2010 for SharePoint Online and for SharePoint On-Prem a full Visual Studio developer experience. So part of the Visual Studio tools are SharePoint development tools. And they include tools for sandbox solutions, which is what I'm going to talk about here for a minute. Sandbox solutions are a capability where you can package up some SharePoint functionality of some specific kinds, and you can upload that package to a remote SharePoint server, and it'll run inside of a protected sandbox on the server where it'll be isolated from other people's code, so it won't have the effect on other people's tenancies and other site collections. But it'll still allow you to write custom code, things like custom web parts and event receivers, and execute them in environments like SharePoint Online. So if you're not familiar with that, I'll do a couple of slides on what that sort of, what are the capabilities and limitations of the sandbox and how the sandbox works, just as a quick overview. And then I'm happy to point you to more resources on it, or I can answer questions afterwards too. The basic idea is that there's some isolation to code access. It gets access to a subset of the SharePoint object model. It has a restricted CAS policy so that it can't do a lot of things that would be dangerous or potentially affect other tenancies. And it's also isolated at the process level. So even at the OS level, there are a bunch of things it can't do, like access the network or change the registry settings, things like that. And the types of code you can create are web parts, custom code-based web parts, event handlers, so things that run in response to SharePoint events, like list item creation, deletion, things like that. Workflow activities. So in SharePoint Designer, when you create a declarative workflow, you can create a custom workflow activities in the sandbox. And then feature receivers, which are code that runs when a feature is activated, deactivated, installed, or uninstalled. So a couple of things that I want to stress about the sandbox. I sort of briefly talked about these. It gives you a really quick way to develop something, deploy it just by uploading to a document library. Literally, it's just a solution document library that you upload and activate. So it's a very quick and easy way to develop a solution. It does have limited access to SharePoint APIs. So similar to the client object model, there is a smaller set than the server, than the full server object model that you have access to in terms of SharePoint. And there's another slide on here that has a link to the MSDN resources, all of which will say, is it available in the sandbox or not? If you look at every sort of class and method in MSDN, they have that, is it available in the sandbox piece. And then its usage of server resources are monitored. So if you have a web part that's taking too much compute or making too many database round trips or things like that, it'll be shut down so that it doesn't damage the farm's availability. So that's all related to the custom code creation process, which may be interesting to some of you. Another aspect that I want to stress about sandbox solutions is they're also a deployment mechanism. So we have this site collection gallery where you can package up files, not just assemblies that are code, but also random files, things like Silverlight files or master pages, page layouts, CSS files, JavaScript files. So if you have components that you need to deploy in sort of a reproducible, easy way in a lot of different site collections or with a lot of different clients, sandbox solutions are a good thing to consider there as well, even if you're not using them for custom code. They can also just deploy files into the site collection. So it's another key capability to talk about with sandbox solutions. This is, I think, second to last slide on sandbox I want to go through really quickly. This is the general architecture for how the sandbox runs, which may give you an idea of what the infrastructure looks like. So if you think of a web request coming in from an end user to a web page on SharePoint, the IIS worker process is going to handle it first, and at some point it's going to notice that something inside of it involves a sandbox code request. So for example, say it has a sandboxed web part on it. So it notices that there's a sandbox web part on it, and that execution wrapper will actually call to a different machine. It'll ask the host service there to process the request for that web part. So the rest of the page is going to be executed in that IIS worker process. And for that one web part or event receiver or whatever else, it'll call over into a backend system that will actually execute that sandbox code. The host service will look for a worker process that's available. There actually are a bunch of these configured on each one of the backend servers. And they each have a bunch of different app domains that you can load code into. But these are restricted processes from the operating system perspective. They're stripped of most of the rights of most processes in order to make sure that even if it does something bad, it can't break out of the process. And that code is then loaded into an app domain with a very restrictive CAS policy as well. It's basically the ASP.NET hosting permission minimal level with a couple of extra permissions like calling the SharePoint object model, things like that. And then we load a subset of the SharePoint object model along with that untrusted code in the worker process. And we use .NET remoting so that if you're calling a subset piece of the object model, it can be remoted out to the full object model where you can make transactions to the database and things like that. So that's how we keep you from calling specific things in the full object model of SharePoint that aren't safe from this untrusted code. Any questions about the architecture for sandbox solutions? All right. So last slide, there's some good resources on this. There's a link to the SharePoint 2010 SDK, but there's also a link to all the namespaces and types that are available in sandbox solutions in case you're interested in developing a sandbox solution, seeing exactly what portions of the OM are available. It's right there. These are the different types of code you can write. I already kind of mentioned them, but here's the full list. You can write sort of event and feature receivers. You can write web parts. You can write nifflepuff form logic. You can write these workflow activities. And then in addition to those custom code components that actually are assembly-based, you can also deploy a bunch of declarative things, things like files, content types, master pages, JS files, custom actions, which are extensions to SharePoint user interface. All those things are deployable through these WSPs, so these are important things to consider, too, even if you're not using custom code in SharePoint Online. And then the last piece is a few things that are important to note are not possible in the sandbox. For example, there's no access to the internet to make direct web service calls from the server. So you can deploy a page with JavaScript on it that can make those calls. You can deploy a page with Silverlight in it that can make those calls. You can iframe out to other places. So there are strategies for interacting with external services. But you can't make it directly from that server-side code running in that back-end service. So that's an important thing to know. There's no access to the hard drive to read and write files. You can, of course, read and write to lists and libraries. So if you've got files in libraries, you have access to those. If you've got information stored in lists or in property bags on your web, you can get to that information. But you can't write directly to the web front-end's file system. There are no web application scoped or farm scoped features, so you're deploying things to a site collection at a time. And you can't add assemblies to the GAC. We already sort of talked about that one. The last one is you can't run security-related functionality. So SharePoint has some things where you can, for example, revert to self to do things that only the farm account can do, or run as an elevated user, and you can't do those sorts of things from within sandbox solutions. Okay, so that's my lightning-fast run-through of sandbox solutions. Any questions about that before we get on to SharePoint Online authentication? Yeah. So a farm is a collection of servers that has one or more IIS web applications that are serving SharePoint in them. And a site collection is kind of a SharePoint-specific data isolation boundary. So you can create multiple site collections inside of SharePoint, each of which can have their own collection of sites inside them. But they're kind of a unit of isolation that you define an administrator for each site collection. Permissions are inherited within that site collection individually. And generally speaking, data within a site collection isn't easily accessible without custom code from a different site collection. Does that make sense? They're not synonymous. Site collection is a SharePoint-specific construct, not related to IIS or the things that are serving it. Any other questions? All right. So let's talk about SharePoint Online authentication. And we'll take a little bit longer time on this. I think this is probably something that people are more interested in, so please feel free and interrupt if there are any questions along the way. The first thing I want to talk about is what SharePoint Online uses for an identity provider. So SharePoint Online uses an identity provider called OrgID. And it's a claims-based identity provider. It's in a lot of ways very similar to Windows Live ID, the sort of consumer ID that you get with like Hotmail or a Live account. Except it's actually operated as part of Office 365. So rather than being an ID that's owned by the person who registers it, it's an ID that's owned by the organization that subscribes to Office 365. But from a technological perspective and from a protocol perspective, it's very similar in the sorts of flows that are supported. It can be federated with Live ID and with ADFS. So with Live ID, think of the scenario where I have an Office 365 account. I've got my Office 365 server, and I want to share a document with somebody who's not part of my organization just by giving you their email address. And I can do that because we can federate with Live ID and ask the person to go register for a Live ID, an ID that they'll own, a consumer Live ID, that can then authenticate into SharePoint and get access to that document, even though they're not part of my organization. You can also federate with ADFS. So if on-prem I use AD to manage all of my users, I can federate that with SharePoint Online, with OrgID, so that when people try and go and log into SharePoint Online, they'll actually be redirected to my on-prem ADFS, get authenticated there, and they'll get pushed back to OrgID to then pass that token on and have that federated identity go from on-prem into Office 365. In addition to, so I already mentioned this, an FBA claim server, it also implements this protocol called MSOFBA, which you may be familiar with. It was introduced, I think the first client to support it was Microsoft Office 2007 SP2. There's a declarative document for or a normative reference on it out on our documentation site. I've also got a link to it in here. And it's a protocol that allows non-browser clients to authenticate to forms-based authentication SharePoint servers. And not specifically SharePoint servers, it could theoretically be used for any server, but SharePoint happens to support MSOFBA. So I'm going to talk quite a bit about MSOFBA and how that works, just so you guys get an idea of how to do this authentication. In general, MSOFBA is the protocol that you should use for this programmatic authentication to claims-based servers in SharePoint in general. SharePoint Online happens to be a claims-based server with a claims-based identity provider. There's one sort of exception to this. There's also a notion of Windows claims, which is specific support for doing Windows authentication through claims. And in that case, you can just use Windows authentication, and as a client, you don't have to be aware that it's actually using claims. All right, so does this first slide make sense? I'm going to go through the details of actually the process and the protocol and the flow in just a second, but I want to make sure that the slide on what the identity provider is makes sense.
So the OrgID manage users, or it manage sites or customers?
Users. It manages users, yeah. OrgID is just an identity provider, so all the authorization information is still in SharePoint. But whenever you try and authenticate to SharePoint, you're actually going to be redirected to OrgID in order to authenticate with OrgID, and then you'll be passed back a token to SharePoint that says who you are.
Is it also part of Azure or other cloud solution?
Right now, OrgID is just part of Office 365. But it's the same IDP that you'll use for SharePoint Online and Exchange Online and Link Online. Okay. All right, so this is, Mike actually showed this, I think, very briefly in his presentation. This is the high-level diagram from the MSOFBA protocol document. And it basically comes in three phases. So first, the client makes an HTTP request to the server. And it sends some specific information that I'll talk about in just a second, to indicate that it's not a browser. So it lets the server know, hey, I'm making a request and I'm not a browser, but that request is totally unauthenticated. So the response is that you get a specific 403 that's telling the browser that you can't make that sort of unauthenticated request, and it gives it enough information to go find the login URL, the forms-based login URL that needs to be used to authenticate to this particular server. At that point, the client is going to request the HTML from that forms URL. And most clients will do that by opening up a browser control and pointing that browser control at that login URL. But theoretically, if you wanted to parse HTML and produce post responses and all that kind of stuff, you could do it without it. And then you'll interact with that IDP, with that login URL, and at some point you'll post your authentication information. This may take several different round trips depending on what the server is. You might have to put in a username and password. You might have to have a PIN. There might be some other sort of capability there. What you do in this post and the return HTML here aren't really governed by the protocol. You can authenticate the user any way you want. But once the user is authenticated, the idea is that you'll set a cookie and you'll redirect the browser back to a specific URL that will let the client know that the authentication is complete. And once the client knows that the authentication is complete, it'll grab the cookies from that response and use that cookies on any of the following requests that it wants to make to the protected resource. Okay, does that high level make sense? We're gonna go through request by request here in just a second. Cool. All right, so this is the first request. This is how you initiate the protocol. You first make an unauthenticated request to the server that's gonna indicate to the server that you're a non-browser client. And you can indicate that to the server in one of three ways. The sort of preferred way is to pass this field name, xForms-based auth accepted. This header, if you set the value to T for true, means that you're a non-browser client and you accept this forms-based authentication. So the server should respond to you as if you are a non-browser client. For reasons of mostly legacy, but also for reasons of pragmatism about changing existing protocols supported by people outside of Microsoft, we also have some specific logic about some specific user agents that will respond to in very specific ways. So for example, this is the front page user agent. It's been used by front page since, maybe 1997 even, and is used by SharePoint Designer today. Non-browser is another one. If you want to indicate that your non-browser is kind of a standard one that people use in a lot of different protocols. WebDAV mini reader has a specific user agent that we'll check for. But if you set any of these user agents on your request, it'll indicate to the server that you're a non-browser client that supports forms-based authentication and should be given the appropriate response. And the last is if you use the options verb, which generally speaking browsers don't use. So we assume that if you use the options verb, we can respond to you with the specific request that's intended for non-browsers. Okay? The server is then going to respond with a 403, and that 403 contains this specific header, xForms-based auth required, and has as the value for that header the login URL where they want to send you to go log in. I'll show you a couple of examples in Fiddler in just a second, but that's going to be the place where we'll then load a browser control and let the user log in that browser control. There are another couple optional parameters. One is the return URL, and this is the sort of final URL. Once authentication is complete, where am I going to be? And telling the client that lets it know, when you see this URL, you're done, and you should then assume that all the authentication is complete, and you can take the cookies out of the request and use those. And then the last is an optional parameter where you can tell the client your preferred dialogue size, if you'd like to have a specific size of dialogue when it's loaded so that there's a better user experience for your particular login form. The client will then make a browser request to the login URI. So at that point, the user agent's going to be a browser user agent. Again, it doesn't necessarily have to be a browser, but parsing all the HTML and sending the appropriate posts would be about the same complexity as implementing your own browser. So creating a browser control is probably the easiest way to do this. The user then authenticates through whatever mechanism is provided by that web UI, and then when you're redirected to that final return URL, or if it's not specified, this guy, then you read all the return cookies and use them in all of your subsequent requests. All right, so I've got a quick demo, and I've actually got a pointer to this sample code too that I can send you at the end, so you can have the sample code to do it all yourself. The basic program here, and this is going to be a command line program, is going to use the client context. It's going to use the client object model that Mike talked about. So we're just creating a client context that's pointing to a target site that I'm going to pass in the arguments when I open this up in a command line. And that client context is going to be created from this get authenticated context method, which is part of the sample code I'll point you to. And that get authenticated context thing is going to, whenever you make a web request, add a collection of cookies, and the cookies are going to be created by this Git authenticated cookies thing, which will do that whole dance that we talked about, where it'll load up a browser control after it gets a specific response from the server. It'll let the user interact with that browser and then wait till a redirect URL is returned. So I'm going to go ahead and open up Fiddler, which again, if you guys haven't used it, this is a free tool out there that's really spectacular for diagnosing web requests. And I've got my, let me close this. I'm going to open up a new browser window and go to my SharePoint Online site. So I'm already authenticated. I need to sign out. Try that one more time. So what's going to happen in the browser case, is you'll see that a couple of requests are made to SharePoint Online. randomtriangle.sharepointonline, which is my site right here. And then at some point, you are redirected to a specific login page at login.microsoftonline.com, which is where that org ID login provider is. You can see we have our 302 at random triangle here. And then the next request is going to be the login to microsoftonline.com. And that result is this page right here, which looks a lot like Live ID. But this is org ID. Like I said, they're very similar. This is just part of Microsoft Office 365. And then I could type in my username and password and hit post, and that would redirect me back to the original URL. The protocol for when I do it through the browser looks very similar, or when I do it through MSOFBA looks very similar. So I'm going to call SPCTX, which is just that command line tool, and I'll send you a pointer to that. I'm going to pass in the URL that I want to go to. We'll see that the first request is an options request made to that URL. So the options request was one of those three options, remember, for indicating that you're a non-browser client. The server responded with the 403 that we expected, or actually, the server responded with the 403. Let me actually show it to you. The server responded with the 403 that we expected. You can see the forms-based auth required header here with information about the page you should go to log in. You can also see the forms-based return URL. So in this case, they're actually not the same. So the client's going to be looking for a different URL that it's coming back to at the end. And then it'll go back to auth required. Sorry, you guys probably can't see that very well. Let me, is that better? So you can see in the 403, you can see forms-based auth required and forms-based auth return URL. These are two different places. This is what the browser is going to look for in order to say, yep, authentication is now complete. I can return and get the cookies. All right, and then, oops. Then you'll see that the control popped up a browser window. So this is part of my client application. If I kill this client application, it'll kill that control. This is just a web control running Trident. If I authenticate in here, I'll show you the HTTPS call because that's got my username and password in it. But you can see a 302 back to this underscore layouts error.aspx, which was the return URL, if you remember that, from the header that was sent originally. So that indicates to the client that I've now authenticated. I've got a bunch of cookies here. In particular, this fed auth cookie is the name of the cookie that I'm looking for in this case. And the fed auth cookie is going to be read from this request, and it's going to be set on all future requests to the server. And the last one that you'll see here is, this one, the client.svc, Client SVC is, again, the endpoint for the CSOM that Mike showed you just a minute ago. And this particular client.svc call is just asking for the web's title. You can see it's passing that fed off cookie, that long fed off cookie. I'll go and show you the code again. It's just asking for the title of the web. And then you can see that after I've authenticated, it's actually got the title out of the web, even though I'm coming from this client application rather than from the browser. All right, so that's the full end-to-end for MSO FBA. Go back here. A few resources that I'll point you to. These are just some marketing and developer resource slides, general things for SharePoint Online. This is the protocol document for MSO FBA. This is a white paper on doing authentication, and it includes a link to all of the code that I just showed in Visual Studio, so you can go through that code line by line and see all the code that we're using to run that sample. And this is just the link to the client object model redistributable. The code uses microsoft.sharepoint.client.dll, which is the CSOM client library. So you'll want to have that too. All right. So that's my quick things that are important to know about SharePoint Online. The point that I hope you take home is that for the most part, things are the same. All of the services that you use are the same. All of the sort of sandbox deployment capabilities are the same. You can still use SharePoint Designer. Farm solutions are really the big thing that you cannot do in SharePoint Online, so keep that in mind. And there's some specific things that you're going to have to deal with for authentication, namely using MSO FBA in order to authenticate users through client applications. Any questions about SharePoint Online or Office 365? Yeah. That'll work for either GET request or POST. It depends on what request you're making. So all of the SharePoint web services, whether you're talking about the OData web services, live listdata.svc that Mike was talking about, or the CSOM services or the SOAP web services, they'll all support those cookies. So you can use that cookie in whatever request you're going to make, and whether it's a GET or a POST will depend on which protocol you're actually calling. But for each one of those, you can use that federated cookie that you got in that authentication request and make the request using that cookie.
Do you have any existing Office client applications that use this protocol now?
Yeah, all of the Office client applications starting in Office 2007 SP2, and again, in all the Office applications in Office 2010 use the protocol. All the core ones, Word, Excel, PowerPoint, OneNote, SharePoint Designer, all of them use MSO FBA to talk to FBA-gated SharePoint sites. Any other questions? All right, thanks very much.